studios of Radio Sai at Prashanthi Nilayam, I am Chandu Vijay and this is Love to Love. And today we have a talk by Brother Hari Shankar, Senior Manager, Medicare Division of the Sri Sathya Sai Central Trust. Hari completed his MBA program from the Sri Sathya Sai Institute of Higher Learning in the year 2002. And prior to that, he had done his BTech from the prestigious Indian Institute of Technology, Chennai. In this talk, he speaks about suffering and how to deal with it. This talk was delivered in the Satsang Hall here in Prashanthi Nilayam on the 21st of May 2016. Stay tuned, dear listeners. After the talk, you'll be treated to some soulful bhajans from the album Bhavanjali Volume 1 produced by Sai Blossom. After which, at 3:30 p.m., we will have the live Telugu segment Sri Sathya Sai Divya Sandesha Chari. And for now, over to Brother Hari Shankar.
Sai Ram, I place my humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. A few days ago, one of our former teachers from the institute, from Sri Sathya Sai Institute of Higher Learning, he was very close to Bhagwan. He had the fortune of staying with Swami in the Purnachandra residence. So he had a very small vignette of his experience to share, and he mentioned this. He said that, after one of the evenings that the students, they found themselves all together, they were having a small debate. The debate was this, that there are so many people who during darshan they hand over letters to Bhagwan, and then so many more they come through courier and through post. So in a day, perhaps Swami was receiving like 3,000, 5,000 letters a day. And they would see Swami thumbing through some of the letters, not opening many of them. And ultimately it was this professor's duty that he had to destroy these letters at the end of the day. So he was also participating in the debate. And the debate was, does Swami read all these letters? Does he know the contents? So many of us write, ultimately the letters are getting destroyed. So why do we write letters to Bhagwan? And he was part of this debate. He was a professor of physics, very rational person. And he said, see, like physically, Swami is God, no doubt. But physically, Swami will definitely not be able to go through any of the letters. Maybe a handful in a day. This is what he asserted. And he left it at that. Next morning, Swami is in the interview room after darshan, and he had his duty in the interview room. Swami calls him in and he's standing respectfully at a little distance, and Swami is thumbing through the letters. And Swami suddenly looks up at him and he says, last night you had a doubt about me, isn't it? So he was still thinking what was the doubt, and then it struck him. Then Swami said, see, if such a doubt ever comes in your mind, why don't you come and ask me? I'm available. So then he says, no Swami, this is what was my view. I thought that so many letters Swami receives, definitely you'll be able to read only a few of them. Then Swami said, okay, sit down here. And he took out a couple of letters which were unopened, the seal was still there. And he handed over to him. He said, see, you go through this letter. Just the starting bit, okay? Just the first two paragraphs, you read them. So he started reading, and as his eyes were running over the letter, Swami started vocalizing what was in the letter. Swami said, see, a few years ago, this person had come here, he had prayed to me that he wants his son to be established in a good job. And I have made sure through my blessings that it happens. And now he's thanking me for that. And he said, stop there. That's it. Just read the first two paragraphs. After that, it gets more personal. Then Swami said, do you think I've opened this letter? And he said, no, Swami. Then how do I know the contents of this letter? And this was a professor of physics. It was completely out of his league. So he said, Swami, I don't know. In all humility, I just don't know. Then Swami said, where do you think I am? Do you think that I only inhabit this small 5 foot frame, 5 foot 3 inch frame. Do you think this is where I live? Then he said, no, Swami. It was getting more apparent to him that Swami was more than that physical frame. And Swami said, I am in each one of you. That is where I live. I am in each one of you. Every living, every conscious or non-conscious thing in this universe, I live there. The moment the thought comes to you of writing the letter, who do you think puts that thought in your mind? He said, it is I. So don't you think I will not know what you are going to write next? Then the obvious doubt was, then Swami, why do you even collect letters? In that case, let all the people know that this truth, and then nobody needs to write letters to you. Then Swami said, no, it is for your satisfaction. At the physical level, you feel like handing over that letter, and when you hand over that letter, you feel that, you know, all your worries have been handed over to Bhagwan and you are free from them. And that is why I do it. I recall one of my friends, my classmates in the MBA. See, those days Swami used to just, you know, in darshan he would say, come, speak. Just a short 2-3 minute speech, but without any preparation. Swami used to train us that way. It's at short notice you should be able to come and speak a few words. The Swami used to call randomly, just come, speak. So this one student, he chose that opportunity to talk to Swami about what our giving a letter to Swami meant to him. So he spoke about once, like he had to literally wait a week. There was something very urgent at home and he wanted to hand over a letter to Bhagwan. So he went through all the trials and tribulations. He laid it out in front of Bhagwan. Swami, this is what we go through when we want to give a letter to you. Then I remember Swami's reaction. Swami liked the talk a lot. And the next 15 minutes, Swami spent going literally to every student and collecting their letters. That day, there's not one student, you know, who had brought his letter and did not hand it over. Some, in fact, started writing then and there as they saw Swami was picking up letters. Just then they took out their pen and paper and wrote letters and handed over to Swami. There were times I have seen, you know, when the students, and Swami used to allow students a lot of latitude. So their letter would just consist of one very small strip called, why are you not talking to me? That's it. Or Swami, tomorrow is my exam, please bless me. Very small chit. And Swami wouldn't mind. He would pick even that small little missive from the students. And this is the one aspect of our relationship to Bhagwan, that Bhagwan knows that as human beings on our life on this planet, a very necessary part of our life over here is this aspect called suffering. It is inevitable, life on this planet. In fact, Swami used to say that pleasure is nothing but an interval between two pains. One of the first truths that the Lord Buddha laid out, he said that there is dukkha in this world. One of the interpretations of dukkha is suffering. So he laid this out. He said this is one of the four noble truths. He said there is dukkha in this world. Inevitable. Happens. And I need not explain to any of you about this. It is something that we experience in our life. And we constantly look for a way out. How do we come out of suffering? Isn't it? That's something, you know, many people pray to God for, and many people do their meditation sadhana. At the background is, I want to eliminate suffering out of my life and I want to get into a place of happiness or bliss. So that is the objective of practically all the sadhana that we do. We keep looking for a way out of suffering. It is said, it's actually a true story, that in Italy, there was this doctor who was very, very famed for curing people of depression. So people would come with all kinds of such mental ailments and they would come to this doctor, and the doctor without fail would cure all of them. So one day he found this one patient who is sitting right across him, and the patient says, doctor, I want you to remove all this sorrow out of my life. I feel a constant sorrow. So the doctor prescribes him, you do this, you do this, you do this. And the whole time the patient is just shaking his head, it won't work, it won't work, it won't work. So doctor tried every prescription. He says, what about these medicines? No, it won't work. And finally, in despair, suddenly a doctor gets a flash of inspiration. He says, yes, I know the perfect cure. Luckily for you, today in our town, the very best comedian in Europe, in all of Europe, he is there in our town. And he's having a show tonight. Why don't you go to that show? I'm telling you, he will make you laugh and laugh and laugh so much that all your suffering will disappear. So the patient was interested. He said, oh, at last something that I've not tried before. He says, who is this comedian? And he says, the doctor says, the comedian's name is Grimaldi. He's a very famous comedian. And immediately the patient, his face droops. And the doctor says, why? He says, doctor, I am Grimaldi. So sometimes you see, even the people around us who are making us laugh, who really look so happy, God knows what they're hiding inside. A lot of sorrow. This often happens. They cover up their sorrow, their suffering with a smile. They go through life. And you know what that is like? It is like having cow dung, and over cow dung you smear ice cream. Looks very delicious, but the stink doesn't go away. That's what it's like. So we keep looking for a way out of this. Even in the Rudram, we pray. The Rudram is a prayer for removing suffering or keeping us away from suffering. We pray to the Lord, Lord, we know you carry with you your quiver of arrows. And those arrows, they hurt, they pain. We pray that you keep your arrows in the quiver. Don't direct them at us. I remember one conversation between Anil Kumar sir and Swami. Many of you must be familiar with Professor Anil Kumar. He used to translate Swami's discourses. And so there he was it was in the Kulwant Hall. We were all seated there, and those were beautiful days when Swami would spend a lot of time. He would interact with Anil Kumar sir, and all of us would get the, you know, chance of watching Swami at such proximity. So free he used to be while speaking. And this was a golden chance, and here we were. And that day, you know, Anil Kumar sir was just staring at Swami's face, not speaking a word at all. And this went on for 2-3 minutes. Swami and Anil Kumar sir, they're just looking at each other, no words being exchanged. And they're not feeling uncomfortable about it also, just looking at each other. And then suddenly Swami says, why are you looking at me? He says, Swami, looking at you, I feel so happy. So Swami said, oh, you're feeling happy, is it? He says, yes, Swami. Okay, in that case, I will send some worries your way. I will send you some worries. Anil Kumar sir, believe me, you know, we are all sitting there. We are very aware that we are sitting in the midst of the masters of our destiny. He holds the threads of our life, and there's practically anything that he can do. And this person, this being, is sitting in front of you and saying that, oh, you're happy. Let me send some worries your way. And Swami is very well known for testing his devotees. He has publicly stated that test is my taste. He is very straight about it. If there's one thing that I will give you constantly along with my grace are also my tests. They come hand in hand. So here he is, and it's not an empty promise. Whatever Swami says will happen. If he says, I will send you some worries, you bet worries are coming your way. So it was very interesting to see how Anil Kumar sir would, you know, stave this off. It's a very potent situation. And he escaped out of it so beautifully. He just told Swami, Swami, now I'm 70 years old. I've had my share of difficulties. At least at this old age, let me lead a happy life. So Swami started laughing. He said, no, I was just joking with you. So even, you know, the best among us, we fear the wave of suffering. Any worries, any anxieties, certainly not welcome. And worry doesn't spare anybody. Rich, poor, educated, not educated, no one is spared. Right? So, Swami, he gives us a very different context. In the spiritual context, See, in the material context, suffering is something that we totally want to avoid. It's not, you know, adversity is not something that we welcome. But Bhagwan, he gives us a totally different context to look at suffering. He says that suffering is the, like the balancing act of the universe. Suffering is like the balancing act of the universe. Just have a look at anything in your life, something that you, that pleases you a lot. Say you like a certain food. Some of us like sweets a lot. Just imagine that the dream of our lives would be that if we could consume sweets our entire life, every day, a lot of sweets. And you all know what happens to such bodies, right? Very soon the pancreas, they give up and the doctor is telling you, you got diabetes. And I remember when I was young, see, there were very few varieties of cool drinks, soft drinks. There's just Thumbs Up and Limca and Gold Spot. So I used to love this Gold Spot drink so much that I used to feel that when I grow up, I want to work in Gold Spot. I thought that imagine my life in that factory, the Gold Spot is getting produced, I'm right next to it. And I can consume as much of it as I want, carbonated drinks. And today, luckily for us, Gold Spot itself doesn't exist. And we are all so very aware of the dangers of drinking carbonated drinks. But that's how we look at life. And if these checks and balances were not there, our human tendencies to run after all these material pleasures. It is the check and balance that the universe offers. You cannot have too much of a good thing. That's again an unwritten law. But all of you experience it. There is something, there is a check, there is a balance that is happening. And that is suffering. It pulls us out of that desire. It, you know, it's like that, it's like you feel the sting of that desire. Just when you think that your life is going to be given to these desires, suffering comes and then pushes you away from that. So it's like the check that the universe offers against you being completely indulging yourself in desires. In fact, Bhagwan goes a step further and he says that suffering is like your spiritual catalyst. It catalyzes your spiritual development. And Bhagwan would often mention in discourses, he would give the example of Kunti. And he would say that Kunti would pray to Lord Krishna that, Krishna, give me suffering, give me worries. Let anxieties come my way. And Swami would say, do you all know why she used to say that? She would say that, if I'm always happy, Lord, I might forget you. If I'm always indulging in pleasures, Lord, I might forget you. But at least these worries, they keep me thinking of you. So Lord, really, I welcome suffering as a blessing. And it is a spiritual catalyst. It was the inquiry into dukkha, into suffering, which was what led Lord Buddha into enlightenment. As a young prince who was kept away from all sorrow, all misery, the one time that he went out of his home and he sees these three visions of suffering, and that begins his inquiry. It's a long inquiry which at last leads him to nirvana, to enlightenment. So that triggered off, these three episodes of suffering that he witnessed is what triggers off that inquiry into what is suffering and is there a way out. And as far as we are concerned, we like to peg our worries on God. So we say, see, God is that hanger on which, like, whatever worries we have, we can go and put it on him and we say, now Lord, it's with you. You do what you like. You can take care of me. And the Swami actually, he accepts this for the longest time. But on certain occasions, you will see that Swami looks totally impassive. I remember on one occasion, my mother used to suffer from arthritis. rheumatoid arthritis. But Swami had called us for an interview. He said, you don't need to take any more pills, you know, to cure your arthritis. Instead, you take my vibhuti. I will give you vibhuti. You keep taking them and you'll be all right. So Swami had materialized some vibhuti. He had also given us some packets, some sachets of vibhuti. And my mother used to take a pinch of it every day in water. So she set aside all other medication. So the only thing she used to take every day was a bit of vibhuti in water. That was her medical regimen. Now, after a few days, what happened was the stock of vibhuti got over, whatever Swami had given. And very soon my mother's leg began to swell, the left leg, it began to swell, the feet. So that had me worried. So I didn't know what to do. I went up to Bhagwan and I told him, Swami, that's actually a story in itself, so let me relate it. Now, at that time when my mother's leg started swelling, for some reason Swami was not talking to me. He had, you know, I was passing through a phase where Swami absolutely would not acknowledge my presence. So I was wondering, as you know, I'm seeing on one hand my mother is going through this, on the other hand Swami is not talking to me, what recourse now? So in desperation I sent a letter to Swami. I was in the hostel. I sent a letter to Swami. Swami, my mother is not well and this evening I'll be sitting in the front row, please talk to me. That's it. That was the content of the letter. So I sat in the front row of the Darshan hall that day evening, and Swami, for about half an hour, you know, my heart was beating. He would look at people around me, talk to them, he was avoiding me. Finally, you know, it was like, okay, there's nothing else I can do now, I have to talk to this guy. And Swami looked at me, he asked, okay, what happened? How is your father? So I say, Swami, father is all right, my mother is not well. Okay, what happened to your mother? See, the whole time I'm not, you know, this tone is exactly the way Swami was talking to me. It was like, he didn't want to, but he just had to. So Swami said, okay, what happened? So I said, Swami, my, you know, mother's leg, it has swollen up. Why has it swollen up? So I say, Swami, the vibhuti that you gave me, that has got over. Swami said, what about the vibhuti I gave you? This is the face. That's it. No compassion. Just, I have given you vibhuti, what happened to that? So this was at that very moment, you know, what I felt like. It when I'm looking back, I look at as if, you know, there is a bird, like a fledgling bird, it is in the nest. So all these days, it is the mother that has done the flying around. It has gone all around. It has picked up the food. It comes, asks the baby to open its mouth and it feeds. Goes on for many days. One particular day, what the mother bird does is to kick this baby out of its nest. And at that moment, the baby actually panics. It's a long fall from the nest down to the ground. And as it goes down, the thoughts go, oh, my mother has deserted me. What am I to do? I'm all alone in this world. And suddenly it realizes, wait, my mother, what would it do? It would fly. It would flap its wings. Let me start flapping my wings, and it escapes the ground. And that is what the Lord puts us all through. Those moments when we think, oh, the Lord is not responding to my prayers. How will I get out of this suffering? The Lord whom I would rely on all these years, now all of a sudden has He abandoned me? And this is precisely what the Lord does. He wants us to grow wings of our own. He wants us to soar. Just as He does. He wants us to soar far above the realms where we bind ourselves in. The physical realms, the material realms. This is where He wants us to be. He wants us to soar there. And to get there, He must, at some point of time, He has to kick us out of that nest. And we have to learn to fly. And so we must pay attention to all those lessons that our mother has been teaching us the whole time. So one of the tools that Swami gives us And that tool is this, simply this, very simple. It is being aware of yourself. It's a very abstract statement. I'll make it more concrete in some time. But let us begin with a simple summary of what he says. Swami keeps talking about constant integrated awareness. This is something as students in MBA, this was something very vital to us. We used to be taught every Thursday, we used to have a class on awareness. So Swami used to say that all of us must have constant integrated awareness. Now, how does this awareness thing play out in this context, right? So if you actually notice like what your thoughts are, how your thoughts go about, just keep, you know, if you could stay silent for a few minutes and just keep observing your thoughts, how they go, right? And you'll notice that what you're doing as human beings, most of us are swimming in a sea of opinions, in a sea of judgments, evaluations. Do you notice that? In your life, what you're constantly doing all the time is actually evaluating. This is my favorite theme, but it you know, if you could really get what our lives are all about, if you could really get who we truly are, I think at that minute we'll snap out of whatever we are dealing with. And Swami says that just watch, listen to yourself. Any tradition, they ask you to sit and meditate. Just listen to yourself. What is it doing? Constant evaluation, constant judgment. Right, wrong, should I do this, should I not? Is this good for me, is this bad for me? That evaluation is running all the time. It is running right now. And when I say it is running right now, you're evaluating even that statement. So it is on, like a constant, like a tape recorder. It's just on. It's a commentary. This judgment, this evaluation is a constant thing. It is happening all the time. And not only does it happen all the time, we as human beings give it enormous significance. It is the only thing we listen to. We don't even listen to Swami. We listen to what our voice has to say about what Swami said. Is it good? Is it bad? Recognize that the only master you serve is that little voice in your head. Nothing else. That is your guru, true guru. That is the only real master you're going to serve throughout your life. So we swim in this sea of opinions, judgments, evaluations. That is where our stand is, and we give it enormous significance. It is everything for us. And the prescription, one famous philosopher, he said that there is a cure for this. He says, if you think you value your opinions, your judgments, we all have opinions, right? We have an opinion about who should run this country. We have an opinion about how this country has to be run. Not only this country, we are even worried how should the United States of America be run. Who should be the president of that country? We have an opinion about how our bosses should be. We have an opinion about how our spouses should be. And we judge our children. We judge our parents. We have an opinion about everything. Simple, straight. We have our judgments about everything. So the philosopher said, just try this out, that when you think that your opinions are so important, when you think your judgments are that important to the world, on a starry night, it's a beautiful night, no moon, very beautiful night, the stars are all out there. You can see the stars in the sky. Go out there, turn your head up, look at them, and then start voicing all your opinions at them. One by one. Tell them everything you think. Look at the stars on a moonlit night. Sorry, on a starry night. And tell the stars what you think. And then listen to what they have to say. And what you'll get back from the universe is a frightening silence. What you'll get back from the universe is a frightening silence. The world cares two hoots for your opinion. It gives nothing, absolutely nothing, no 2 cents value to your judgments. Life just goes on. The universe just goes on. Your opinions, your judgments mean absolutely nothing to it. I remember it was the occasion my mother had passed away, and we had performed her rites right here in the Chitravati. So the tradition is that after 3 days you have to go and collect the ashes, right? So by that time the ashes have cooled down, so you can collect it. So I went with my father to the Chitravati sands to collect the ashes. And I remember, as I am scooping the ashes into the urn, on just a few meters away, there are two dogs who are, they're playing so, with so much joy. Like they're really bounding about, can you imagine, have you seen dogs when they get really excited in the way they play? It's a beautiful sight for those who love dogs. And, just a few meters away, they're playing so much aliveness, so alive. And it was a beautiful contrast. On the one side, to the left of me, I am scooping death into an urn. And on my right, there is a scene of enormous life, bountiful life happening. And I realized at that moment, really, what a contrast this universe offers. Because the universe has absolutely no value for what you think of it. Whereas we are the people who go on ascribing meaning at every moment. Something happens, we say, no, this should not happen. This thing happens, no, this should not happen. This isn't right. This is wrong. No, this is right. This is how it should be. No. This is how it should not be. And we indulge ourselves so much in that opinion, at no point of time do we realize that life is just happening without giving 2 cents for what you think about it. It absolutely has no value for what you think about it. In fact, a film writer, he says, the most interesting fact about the universe is not that it is hostile, but that it is indifferent. It is absolutely indifferent. So whenever you feel like you got an opinion, you want to test out that opinion, here's the prescription. On a starry night, go out there and voice your suffering to the stars. Speak to them about it and then listen. Just listen to what they have to say. And we, project that suffering onto others. Sometimes you see these dogs, some of the dogs have 3 legs. And then we look at the dog, we say, so sad for that dog. But just look at the dog is bountifully running about. Like it's got three legs, it'll still run like that, with 3 legs. It'll do whatever it has to. Does the dog have an opinion about the fact that it has 3 legs? Anyone? Does the dog have an opinion? The dog doesn't have an opinion. What does it do? It'll just run with the 3 legs that it has. It is human beings that will say, oh, poor dog. And the dog will not understand why it is getting that much sympathy. It's just happy. That's it. The human being is interested in me. That's all it cares about. It doesn't know. That you are saying, oh, 3 legs. 3 legs? What 3 legs? It's all right. Right? So this is the voice that says in our head, there is something wrong here. It's an evaluation, it's a judgment that there is something wrong here. This is not a voice that is always there, and the psychologists, they have distinguished that it happens somewhere between the ages 3 and 4, that the voice in our head starts saying that there's something wrong here. The voice called something wrong here originates sometime around that time, and it stays with us right up to the end of our lives. The conversation that goes, there's something wrong here. And notice it is there everywhere. Those of you who worked in offices, anyone here who has worked in an office, a job somewhere? Yeah. So notice when you join the job, everything is fine. You know, maybe for the first 1 or 2 weeks, then something snaps and the conversation starts. Oh, there's something wrong here. Maybe the pain slip comes in, you know, one day late. Or the boss who was smiling all the time, suddenly one day he just screams at an employee, not at you, somebody else, there's something wrong here. You welcome the daughter-in-law to your house. And the first day that when you tell her something and she says, no, I will not do, there's something wrong here. It is a conversation that is there with us at all times. You come to the ashram, oh, Swami's ashram, Prashanti Nilayam, the abode of supreme peace. And in that devotional mood, you have prayed in your room, and you are going to Mandir, and just as you are about to enter the Kulwant Hall, Sevadal says, hey, you can't enter here. Why are you standing here? Go somewhere else. There's something wrong here. So this is the conversation that is there with us throughout, and the access to really going beyond this suffering is to actually have a look at, like, what is this conversation about? Is it real? There is something wrong here. It happens in a snap. And the moment you can hear that voice, the moment you become aware, that is the awareness. The moment you become aware that this conversation is playing about in every part of my life, in every sphere of my life, that is when you have a smite of a chance of actually getting out of that conversation. Of actually looking at, is there something wrong here? Is that just my judgment? Is it an evaluation? And that's when you snap out of it. You get off it. And then it is then you begin to notice that the only person who says that there is something wrong here is you. No one else. The universe didn't come and say, look, there is something wrong here. It didn't put it out here, you know, like a sign that says, there is something wrong here. Watch out. No. Universe doesn't do that. Universe just is. Life just is. Then who is saying that there's something wrong here? It is we. We say that there is something wrong here. Even the dog doesn't say that there is something wrong here. It is we, human beings, who have language. In our language, we have this word called wrong. And then we use that word to say that there is something wrong here. So, the great masters, they recognize that all of life happens in a conversation. It is a conversation in our head. There's something wrong here is a conversation. So the great masters, what they do is, they give us the antidote. They say, okay, fine. You say there's something wrong here. Here, I'll give you something to deal with it. And they say, one of the biggest, greatest conversations is, this too shall pass. It is said that there was a king in the Middle East, one of the Arab kings, and he used to be troubled with anxieties the whole time. And he had heard that there was a Sufi saint who was just living outside his kingdom. So he goes to the Sufi saint and he says, Lord, tell me what to do. I just can't seem to get rid of anxieties and worries. So the Sufi says that, here, I'll give you a small little ring. And he gives him a ring, puts it on his finger, and the king reads what is written on that ring. This too shall pass. This too shall pass. There is, in fact, it was the theme for a convocation drama that was played in front of Bhagwan in the year 1999. The constant theme was, it was like Yudhishthira, he would use this phrase that whatever sufferings the Pandavas went through, and they had more than their share of suffering, at every stage when things really heated up to a point when the Pandavas felt they would all snap At that time, Yudhishthira, he would calm them all down. He would say, this too shall pass. This too shall pass. And this too shall pass. So, recognizing that it's whatever is happening is just a conversation, the great masters, they give us the antidote and they say that this too shall pass. And Bhagwan, he goes a step further. He gives us a more powerful conversation. Swami says that whenever suffering comes your way, adversity comes your way, you say that this is for my good. This too is for my good. There's a beautiful story in the Tao tradition in China. It is said that there was this farmer who lived with his family, his son, young son, in that farm. And he had this one horse that was his property. And one day the horse, you know, the stable is open, the horse just runs out from the farm. And the neighboring villagers, they all come, they say, oh, so sad, you just lost your horse. And he says, we'll see. That's all he says, we'll see. Then after a few days, that horse returns and it brings with it three more horses. It has found friends somewhere in the forest and it leads the friends back to its own place. Oh, then all the villagers, they converge to his place. They say, oh, congratulations. Your good, bad fortune a few days ago, it's turned into your good fortune now. Now you have four horses when you lost one. Fantastic. He says, we'll see. So after a few days, his youngest son, he tries to ride that horse. It's an untamed horse, new one. It's a wild horse, so it's not learned to take humans on its back. So as he's running, that horse, you know, pushes him off its back. He falls on the ground, he's badly injured, and all the villagers, they come and they say, oh God, such bad fortune, such ill luck. He'll say, we'll see. Then again, after a few days, what happens is that kingdom goes to war. Now, during the war, they're trying to conscript all the young men, they're trying to draft all the young men into the army. So, the king's men, they knock on the farmer's doors. They say, do you have any young boys to offer to the army? And he says, I have this one son. And he shows, but that young son is confined in bed. He is injured. And then when they go away, again the neighbors, they come. Oh, you're so lucky. Your son was not conscripted into the war. He says, we'll see. So it's all a matter of our conversation. Who says that this is good, this is bad, this is right, this is wrong? This should be, this should not be. There's something right here, there is something wrong here, is our conversation. Doesn't happen anywhere else except here. Nowhere else. Out here in life is just stony silence. Just happening. Like a flow. Just goes on and on and on. In fact, you will notice by now that it is not the situation, it is not what's happening out there that creates suffering or sorrow. By now you will notice that there is nothing out there that can cause anxiety. There is nothing out there which you can label as an obstacle or as an adversity. Where does it happen? In here. In our language. It's what we say. In fact, the Zen masters, if you go to them and you say, Master, it is hot. They say, if you say so. No, Master, it is very pleasant here. Oh, if you say so. Master, this lecture of yours was very good. If you say so. Master, I got really, really bored. If you say so. Where does it happen? Does it happen out here in life? No. The only place it happens is in our conversation. Nowhere else. And the moment we get that, you know, we get to see this in our lives, that is our smite of a chance to snap out and to get off that conversation. So what would you do, right? It's like, you know, one exercise they do. They say, you know, here's a vanilla ice cream and here's chocolate ice cream. Okay. The kid disappeared. Otherwise, I would have tried it out. So there's a vanilla ice cream and there's chocolate ice cream. Which one would you choose? So some say, I'll choose vanilla. Okay, good. Why? So they say, I like the taste. I like this. I like the texture, etc. Again, chocolate, vanilla, which will you choose? Right? And so we go on and on and on. For everything, a person will keep giving reasons. Why do I like vanilla ice cream? Or why do I like chocolate ice cream? There's got to be some reason, no? Some reason. And if I keep asking you why, beyond the 10th time, you have run out of actual reasons, and then you'll begin to manufacture reasons. You see, you go to children in school who have not done their assignment the day the teacher has asked them to do, you ask them, like, why did you not submit your assignment? And then watch the reasons that come out. The stories that come out would win a Nobel Prize in itself. They'll say, you know, this morning I had the assignment in my hand and I was walking out of the house and then one dog was there. The dog, it went and barked at a cow. And then the cow got so scared, it went and urinated on a snake. And then the snake came, it went and bit that dog. And the dog got scared, it came running towards me. And then it caught my assignment. And then what happened, seeing the snake, an eagle came down. And it, while trying to catch the snake, instead of catching the snake, it caught my assignment and then went into the sky. So where is my assignment? Up there with the eagle. Go ask the eagle. So those are the stories. We can manufacture reasons, right? We need reasons for every small thing that we do. Why did you go to Puttaparthi? Reason is there. Why did you go for this talk? A reason is there. And I ask you 10 times, why did you go for the talk? After the 10th reason, new reasons, invented reasons will start. So we are, as human beings, we are capable of ascribing reasons for everything. So when I ask you, choose vanilla, choose chocolate, you will give me a reason for choosing either one of them. Now, what does life do? It takes vanilla ice cream, thrusts in your face and says, choose. Does life give choices? Death of a loved one, choose. Loss of a job, choose. Failure in your exam or job, choose. In your face, choose. Good parents, choose. Choose good parents. No, parents who are very dominating, those who don't, you know, they're not very loving, choose. And we resist and resist and resist and resist. And we say, oh, life is full of suffering. Adversity, choose. Believe me, this conversation is so powerful. I recently met this lady who had lost her 20-month-old child. I cannot think of something that can, you know, be more devastating than that. And I saw the moment she made the choice. She said, yes, I choose my daughter's death. There's something, that second she could snap out of it. She could see something opening up for the rest of her life. Because, see, what I'm talking about is the long-term suffering, right? So people go through situations, traumatic things that happen in their life, and it affects them for the rest of their life, right? But these are the sufferings that you and I know about. See, there are things, if when I talk about this, all of you have something that's happened in the past, no? That's affecting you today. Something that the moment you think about it, it brings you a little bit of sorrow, yeah? So those are things you know about. But there are sufferings which happen even when we don't know about it. We just don't know. These are the insidious the deep inside, causes of suffering, which are right with us. We hold it in our hands. And the only way that we can let go of that is by just letting go. So Bhagwan says, he would give the example of what we do, you know. So he said that there is a beautiful trick that the monkey catchers, they employ to catch monkeys. So what they do is they take an empty coconut shell, and inside that shell they keep something very tasty, maybe nuts, something that the monkeys love a lot. Okay, so the monkey goes about somewhere, sniffs good food, looks for the source of the good food, and it is there inside that coconut shell. It puts the hand inside the shell and grabs that food. So now the hole is made such that the monkey's hand, when it is free, it will go right through. But when it is made into a fist, the monkey cannot withdraw its hand. Right? So Bhagwan says that is how the monkey trappers, this is how they trap monkeys. So the moment the monkey's hand is in that thing and it is trying to remove, it cannot. So it keeps banging, 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 and that is the trigger. The noise alerts that monkey trapper that, oh, the monkey is caught. And do you think the monkey trapper, then he runs quickly, he is in a hurry because he is afraid the monkey will run away? Rest assured that monkey is not going to run away. Because as it tries to remove its hand, it's not able to remove its hand. Because it's tightly holding on to whatever is there. It's just not able to. At no point does it realize that if I can leave that food, free my hand up and remove my hand, I am free. So the monkey trapper, coolly, he just walks like that, relaxed. He can take his own sweet time because he knows that monkey is going nowhere. The monkey is in his hands now. And that's true of all of us. We do not even realize. And do you know where to look for this? Look for all the complaints that you have about life. All the complaints. It keeps happening. All the complaints that we have. Complaints about our colleagues, people around us. Complaints about life. Complaints about our country. Oh, this country doesn't work. Electricity is not there, internet is not there, this is not there, that is not there. The constant complaints. Arey, my husband is like this. My wife, no, you just have to listen to her for 5 minutes, then you will know. You give discourse up there, come and meet my wife, then you'll know. My teenage son. Just if I say teenager, there are people laughing in this room. That's all I need to say, teenager. That's it. And that's how it happens, see? We don't even know, right? So the moment, like I realized this, I had this complaint against a colleague of mine. For whatever reason, I felt that this guy, you know, he is not doing what he has to do to earn his salary. And I held that against him. And it was there. So we were pretty close friends. And after a while that, you know, when it happens like this, we started drifting. So we were in the same office, few feet from each other, but we started living our own lives. Nothing common anymore. So it went on and on and on. At some point of time, I realized that there's something, you know, that we can have a better life than this. So I was looking at what can I do, and I realized that my hand was in a coconut and I was holding on to that this person is wrong about what he is doing. I just held on to it. Now look, why does a monkey hold on to that food? Not for a moment. See, if a mosquito comes and lands on your hand, there is something you're going to do about it, right? When it starts stinging you and tries to remove blood from you and you feel upset about it, there is something you want to do about it. Yes or no? You will, you know, some of us will swat the mosquito, and those who are more spiritually aware, they'll say, no, I should not kill and blow the mosquito away. But something we will do, right? And so we actually have the power of removing that complaint from our lives. But see this monkey now, coming back to the monkey. Monkey is holding on to something in that coconut. Why is it holding on to it? Because there is something about that food, no? It will bring it joy. That is why we hold on to complaints. See, when we say that that person is wrong, then who is right? Who is right? I am right. If that person is like a bad person, who gets to be the good person now? I. If that person did wrong to me, who is the person who is now, who earns sympathy from people? Who is now getting the attention from people? Me. Not you, me. Right? So that is why all of us as human beings, we do not let go of that. There is some juice we are getting out of it. Kuch to mil raha hai humko. We hold on to it. Something I am getting. When I complain about the circumstances around me, I get to escape complete responsibility. It's not my responsibility anymore. It belongs to who? Somebody else, not me. Right? We do not even notice this suffering. So the moment I decided that, look, the one thing I've got to drop out here is I'm going to drop this complaint I have against my friend. Because what I saw in this situation is I'm not helping him. But what I'm getting out of it is that I feel very happy, I am right and he is wrong. That's it. It's a small little joy in life. So I went up to him and I said, see, this is what I held against you. And he said, Hari, you don't know actually, I was aware of this and there are circumstances in my life that I'm dealing with. That his mother was extremely sick, critical, and he was trying to do something for the family, which is why he was not able to be so much in the job. He was not able to contribute at work, and I didn't know that. Can you see that? The nastiness that we get into. This is the nastiness in our lives. And so the moment I decided, yes, I'm going to drop that. See, now I have my friend back in my life. There are people in your lives whom you are holding something against and you think that, yes, I am getting something out. And Swami compares this. He says, have you seen dogs? You know, the dogs, they like to chew on bones. And you see, what is the joy in bones? There's no meat on it. There's nothing. It's totally stale. So what is the joy that a dog gets out of chewing on a bone? It's on blood. Swami says that as, you know, the dog chews, its gums get stressed and the blood starts oozing out. And the dog, it's tasting its own blood and saying, wah, kitna taste hai. Wah, wah, wah. Beautiful. That's what we are doing, right? Chewing on a bone. They say that when you hold a grudge against somebody, they say you're chewing a bone. The reason is this, because when you chew that bone, the taste that you're getting is actually your own blood. You're drawing your own blood and feeling very happy about it. Right? And that's the thing. Like, this is the suffering that I spoke of maybe for the first 45 minutes is that suffering that we can see. It's in front of our eyes. But there is a suffering that we are not aware and we are not even aware that we are not aware. That's the sad part. There is suffering we are not aware of, maybe. That's all right. Then there is a suffering we are not even aware that we are not aware about it. And that is a suffering that causes us to hold on to things, thinking that it is giving us joy. But Swami says, just let go. Just let go and then see what happens. You can run free. Absolutely free. And so, suffering or adversity is a ladder. Most of us think that I am stuck. The moment I reach an obstacle is where I am stuck. But Swami says that treat this suffering as your ladder. It is your catalyst for spiritual development. And the ultimate goal is, as a great Zen master puts it, it's a beautiful analogy. And they say, most of us human beings, where we are at is, our minds are like water. I throw a pebble into that water and the waters are going to stir. There'll be ripples, and for a very long time the water is disturbed. Right? Happens with each one of us, no? The situations we encounter, how long it takes for us to come out of it. And so the masters say that you should develop such muscle, such understanding, such maturity, make your mind like honey. You disturb a vat of honey, it may be for 1 second, just disturbs, goes like this, maybe once more like this, and it is back. And so the Lord has given us practically everything we need. Nothing of what I said is my own, it is not original. I have had the benefit of listening to Bhagavan's discourses, and I have had the benefit of having friends who would have us mull over it, teachers would make us mull over it, and I am sharing only from that. All of this is there with our mother. It's our mother who is giving us all this. And what does the mother want from each one of us? Does she want us to always depend on the food that she gives? She says, no, I want you to fly just the way I do. I want you to fly. I'm flying and I want you to fly. That is where the mother is. So, in all of this, there's one thing that I find common to all devotees is that there's something we want to give back to Bhagwan, no? At all times. For just the fact of His sweet presence in our lives. Sometimes when I just think of Him, His face, the robes, the feeling of His robes on us, the majesty and the grace with which He would walk about. Just the fact that when He used to be around, all our worries, our anxieties, everything used to melt away, no matter what it is. His pure, innocent countenance, merely looking at that, and we would feel that everything is right in this world, merely looking at Him. Just His very look, He just needs to look at us once, and we would feel that our life's purpose is fulfilled. It now has some meaning. And there's something we want to offer back to this Lord who has given us everything. And He doesn't want anything else. Believe me, if people have said, Swami, I offer my devotion to you, and He says, no, I don't want your devotion. All I want is your transformation. And this is what we have all set ourselves as a goal. When we sit here, when we come to Prashanti Nilayam, this is the gift we want to offer to our Lord. So, let us pray that we immerse ourselves in the teachings of our Lord with the objective that we'll please Him with our transformation. Right? And there is a prayer that we all chant in the Hindu tradition, which is a prayer for enlightenment. And I'd like to conclude this talk with that prayer.
Asatoma Sadgamaya Tamasoma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Amritangamaya. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. जय बोलो भगवान श्री सत्य साई बाबा जी की Oh, 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 oh Ganeshwara Ganadhipa
Ganeshwara Ganadhipa
Ganeshwara Ganadhipa
Ganeshwara Ganadhipa
Vigneshwara Vinayaka
Vigneshwara Vinayaka
Vigneshwara Vinayaka
Vigneshwara Vinayaka
Ganeshwara Ganadhipa Nirvikalpa Niramaya
Nirvikalpa Niramaya Nirvikalpa Niramaya
Ganeshwara Ganadhipa
Ganeshwara Ganadhipa
Vigneshwara Vinayaka
Vigneshwara Vinayaka
Ganeshwara Ganadhipa
Ganeshwara Ganadhipa
Nirvikalpa Niramaya
Nirvikalpa Niramaya
Ganeshwara Ganadhipa
Krishnaya Vasudevaya Haraye Paramatmane Pranada Klesha Nashaya Shri Govindaya Namo Namaha Shama ಪರಿಪೂರ್ಣ ഘനശ്യാം
ശരണ്യ
रामचंद्र
a single story of His infinite glory, captured through divine discourses, music, bhajans, and through Vedas, talk shows, interviews, panel discussion, and study circles. All brought to you live from the epicenter of our times, Prashanthi Nilayam, India. Radio Sai Thursday Live.